Why is life better with American Family Insurance? Because every policy comes with something very special. A trusted agent who's there to help protect your dreams by finding the right coverage at the right price. Save up to 23% when you bundle home and auto. American Family Insurance. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Head on Fire is a Patreon-supported podcast. Supporters of the show get early access to ad-free episodes, a private Discord server, archives, and more. All benefits are offered on a sliding scale, so no matter your level of donation, you never miss out. If you like this show, consider supporting it with a dollar a month or whatever you can at patreon.com/headonfirepod. Thanks, and enjoy the show.
It is Halloween week, otherwise known as my favorite time of year. There's a chill in the air. Ghosts lurk in all the dark corners of our homes. Monsters roam the streets, and people are getting witchy, whether it's because they're walking the witch's road with Agatha and her coven of chaos, or because something in a perennial Halloween favorite, like the craft or practical magic, struck a chord. People get curious this time of year to see if that spark of magic from movies and books can be found in the real world. Now, this time of year, there is also no shortage of interviews with real witches, but these interviews are conducted by people who are treating their subject like a curiosity rather than a person. You can always sense the vibe that the interviewer thinks the witch before them is, frankly, nuts, that they're a few eyes of newt away from a full cauldron, so to speak. But being a magically minded person myself, as well as the author of The Dabbler's Guide to Witchcraft, I wanted to offer something a little different. The mantle of the witch is one that has been worn by people for all sorts of reasons. There are those who don the black hat for political purposes. It's a feminist symbol and a place for those who find themselves on the margins of society in one way or another to reach for the power they otherwise could never hope to have. Then there are the people who call themselves witches because they cast spells and divine the future and talk to the dead. And still, there are others conjuring up new titles or resurrecting old ones, all in an attempt to define a personal spiritual path that is inclusive, empowering, and allows for a spark of magic in the real world. I summoned three fabulous witches to help me call the corners, cast a circle, and chat all about how to walk the witch's road in real life. Here's Thorn Mooney, Courtney Weber, and Mawia Bomani. Hello, witches. Welcome to Head on Fire. Thank you so much for being here. This is so exciting. I haven't done like a roundtable on this show in like, I think maybe ever. I don't think I've done like a good old-fashioned roundtable discussion on Head on Fire since it was rebranded. So this is a really fun treat for me, getting back to my witchy roots. So for my audience, if folks have never heard of all of you, I want to go around and have all of you introduce yourselves and maybe talk about what it is that you do, maybe if you have any books out or anything like that. We're going to start with Mawia right up at the top.
All right. I'm Mawia Kai Eljemabomani. I am a writer, a teacher. Right now I'm in the classroom where fifth graders just left, so it's kind of crazy. And so I wrote a book called Conjuring the Calabash, Empowering Women with Hoodoo Spells and Magic. And I love that little book. It's a book for people who are new to hoodoo, as well as people who practice hoodoo, just to sort of give them a refresher on it. It really opens it up for women, but also as women, as leaders of our family, you know, we can help out with our children and with our elders. So that's me.
It's a beautiful book. It's so
Thank
good.
You.
It's
Thank
so
you.
Good. Thorn.
Hi, I'm Thorn Mooney. My latest book is Witches Among Us, Understanding Contemporary Witchcraft in Wicca. I'm really excited about it because I'm actually a doctoral student at, where do I go to school? The University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill in the Religious Studies Department. And it was an opportunity to write the book for outsiders that I always want, both as a classroom teacher and as a practitioner. So I'm not writing from the perspective of being particularly invested in any one type of witchcraft. I wanted to write a truly neutral guide that you could give to your mom or your new partner or your therapist.
That the lovely update to Cunningham's whatever the hell that was called.
The witchcraft. Truth about witchcraft in 1989.
That, I was gonna say, not Witchcraft Today. Isn't that Gardner?
That Yes. The best book about Wicca ever. Witchcraft Today. No. Yeah. Cunningham's Truth About Witchcraft Today. The Truth About Witchcraft in 1989, as I affectionately call it.
I am very excited about that book because I got to read it. I got to read it a long time ago before it was a thing. And it's really good. You're like a really good writer, and I hate you a little bit. Miss Courtney, hi, how are you? My October nemesis.
I know, we have fights.
We do.
We're frenemies this time of year.
So if folks don't know you or know you from my comment section.
Yeah. I'm that witch. But most people say I'm that bitch. I said I'm that witch. That makes dawn quiver in the dark of night, and not
the
in a good way.
Corn.
Yeah, the candy corn queen. My name is Courtney Weber. I am an author and a witch, and I refer to myself as a guide for the magically minded. My work is about undoing the harmful mentality that is imposed upon everybody, whether they like it or not, by modern Western Christianity. So people that are looking to transform their lives on their own terms with witchcraft and tarot as a guide. And I'm the author of I'm the author of 5 books and 1 work of fiction in progress. Agents, please reach out because it's really good.
She's written a lot of books, y'all. She's written a lot of books. She's ahead of all of us.
It's not a race. It's definitely not a race. But
if it were.
Yeah. Oh, I'm also
you would be winning.
I feel the psychic pinch from my co-host. I'm also the co-host of That Witch Life podcast, which is the most serious, professional, grounded podcast on the history of witchcraft. Yeah.
Yeah. It's basically NPR. It's this right. This witchy life.
Yeah. It's this witchy life. This witchy
very
life.
Very sober.
We are sober like 93% of the time, but we're never grounded. I describe it as 30 minutes of dumpster fire and then 45 minutes with an actual witchcraft expert. But the first 30 minutes is me and my 2 best friends from high school just, you know, causing all kinds of shade. It's great.
So it is currently October. I'm actually recording in the month that I'm releasing this for once. So it is October. It is the season of the witch. And a lot of people are going to be getting a little curious, dabbling. They're going to be dabbling a little bit. And I'm curious how all of you got your start. Was it around Halloween? I will go first. I got a little witchy during Halloween. There was a book, and I have it. Last year, year before, I tracked down like a used copy because I just needed to own this book. It was called Witches, Pumpkins, and Grinning Ghosts. And it was this like Halloween book that came out every year. Every year when my family got out the Halloween decorations, all of the Halloween books came out. All those seasonal books came out. And this one was like the real history of Halloween. And it was the first place that I ever heard that like witches were real. And like all of the different like spells that people used to do. It was the first place I ever heard about druids and stuff. Now it was for kids. And I will tell you as an adult going back and rereading it, they do play pretty fast and loose with history, but like the illustrations were super witchy and it was just an amazing vibe. And I was like, oh my God, that's incredible. And it just really like sparked my curiosity for, oh wait, this is real. Like this isn't just something, like this isn't just hocus pocus on Disney. This is, people do this for real. And it made me want to go seek out a little bit more as I got older. What was that first spark of witchy for you all?
It was definitely a Halloween slumber party. So also guilty of that.
It a slumber party that most of us found our way into this?
Yeah. Did it involve a Ouija board?
Always. And tarot cards?
Yeah.
Mine was stories.
In, like, Catholic school bathroom.
That's
what girls were up to.
Yeah. But I need way more information about that. Well, what are we doing in the Catholic school bathroom? It was at Bloody Mary. Are we doing Bloody Mary in the mirror?
We had a girl named Tony, and she was probably the most occult person we knew at that time. And she didn't last long. When the nuns found out that she was actually making a spirit board and bringing it into the bathroom, they were like, you got to go. So we would go in there with her. And so she would just talk to us about, you know, all these people that she wanted to, you know, visit, you know, meet with, all these people in history. And she would pull out her board. And so that was probably the first time that I was introduced to anything like that. And then the sisters were like, we're going to wash Tony's mouth out with soap and she won't be back.
Oh, so this is actually fascinating. So was everyone's like introduction in that more like divinatory talk to the other side kind of vein? Because mine was definitely the, I want to cast spells on the bullies at my school. That was me.
I think for me, it was a little column A, a little column B. Like I religiously watched Bedknobs and Broomsticks as a young kid.
Yes, girl.
And then would try to recreate Angela Lansbury's character spells by trying to get my stuffed animals to come to life. I had them all lined up on the edge of the bed and would just cast that spell over and over again. And I would write it in my little, you know, pink journal. And I was pretty disappointed that it didn't happen. I mean, for me,
I carried those little, the little teeny tiny New Testaments that, yes. Who is it that gives those, the Shriners, whoever
the
gives
Gideons.
Those
yeah, the
Gideons. Gideons. Yeah, the little Gideons. Because I carried those around as my little Angela Lansbury spell book. That was my spell book.
Oh man, that's a good one.
And I would flip it open because it was so tiny and leather bound. And I was like, filigree, apogee, paragraph.
Read the Psalms. But that's the Old Testament, I think. Anyway.
Oh yeah, I've got my long lost friend right there.
Oh God, that's a good one. I've always been the weird kid, like was always the weird kid. I would try not to be the weird kid. And that would just make me even further into the weird kid category. And, you know, I was also a very religious kid. Like I was really into my Catholicism. I did all the stuff I was supposed to do. And I loved the rituals, but it was always felt like there was just something beyond the ritual, like on the other side of the priest knew something I didn't know. My mom's family was, I was raised Catholic, but my mom's family is Southern Baptist from the foot of the Blue Ridge Mountains in North Carolina. And so there's a lot of that culture of referring to spirit and belief in spirit, but also a huge fear of it, like tremendous fear of the devil and therefore a real belief in them. And so
the devil is around every corner. We are praying the devil out of people. We are praying for protection. There's healing. Just, there's the laying on of hands. Yeah.
Right. And I was just like constantly afraid that I would accidentally summon Satan in my living room. I was really afraid that I might like accidentally say 666 out loud and then Satan would appear. I mean, it was just a lot of
my dad got really mad when I would say things like, oh my God. Like it was bad. Like
oh,
saying
yeah.
the Lord.
We used to say, oh, my dog spelled backwards.
Yep.
Right.
Like that's what we used to, oh God. There's the things that we used to do. And then when I was in high school, I started rebelling because I also went to a Catholic high school and, you know, was having more and more issues with the institution of the church as much as the religion, like just sick because it was the 90s. And I was just like, gosh, you gotta stop hating gay people, you horrible, horrible church. And so I decided to create my own religion, which I called Courtneyism. And Courtneyism believed that you could cast spells and believed that fairies were real and ghosts were real and that God was not like a guy in the sky judging you, but was more of an energy that united us. And at the same time, people were giving me books on witchcraft and astrology, just assuming that I was into it. And I was reading tarot cards for all the girls in Catholic high school, just like Maria. Like, you know, we would have been would have had our own coven. You and I would have been the craft if we'd been in high school together for 100%.
Yeah.
And then one day I read a book on Wicca and was like, oh, I'm not a Courtneyist. There are a lot of people out there who believe what I do.
What was everybody's first book? Mine was Earth, Air, Fire, Water, the second in the Cunningham book, the Earth, Air, Fire, Water.
Mine was The Wiccan Mysteries by Raven Grimassi.
Oh, wow. Oh, you dove deep. You were in the deep end. Like
I went into the deep end. Yeah. And I would love to read the book again just for nostalgia's sake. I did have the fortunate chance to meet Raven a few times before he passed. He was such a kind man and so very grounded. It was really a privilege to give him a copy of my first book and just to say, hey, you were the first one I read. Here's the first one I wrote. So circle complete. And he was just so gracious about it. Like just, you know, very humble. And I don't know that I would say he tended to move his work more into a specific Italian front as he got closer. And then a lot of people started being kind of mean to him for it. Like it wasn't authentic enough and stuff. And it always made me really sad because he was such a good man. And maybe his research was a little off, but he was just a genuine person.
Anything that came out in the 80s and 90s and early 2000s, we played fast and loose with research because those, and Thorn, you and I have talked about this, when you go to those bibliographies, it is just other books from the same publishing house.
Well, and I'm gonna kind of hold everybody's hand when I say this.
Oh, I love it when Thor does this. This is so good.
We're actually still doing this.
Yeah.
We're actually still bad. Because research is actually like a skill that you learn formally. Mm-hmm. It's not something that's like innate. And it's right. Like Mawia is a classroom teacher. I was a classroom teacher. It's not like really built into the curriculum very well.
No, it is not. It is not.
So like I teach undergraduates and at one of the best state schools in the country. And this is something that is really difficult. So I just want us all kind of collectively to like take a big sigh and maybe not feel so self-satisfied about being better than.
Right. Well, and that's, I mean, that's why when I decided to write my book, I didn't write a how-to book. I wrote a how-to-do research book.
Right.
I wrote a critical thinking 101 book. I wrote a, okay, there's a, you can read all of your how-tos. You can read your 101s elsewhere. And there's a lot of people. All of you right here, right now, are much better equipped at being, let me hold your hand and walk you through the 101 how-to.
And I think in all areas with the research, you know, I've taught theater for college students and they don't want to research anything. You know, everybody just
such a shame.
Jump in and do things. And it's like, it's hard to even get some people out of the, you know, the sort of the texting language, you know, they want to use that in their papers and different things. So it's really hard to get them to not to just rely on one source, right? Or one area, just to branch out and to really look for things. And so, yeah, I see that all the time. So
I've always thought that good spiritual research is not just deep, it's broad.
Right.
That, especially when you're the kind of, you know, I like to use the word dabbler, but when you're the kind of people that are doing what Courtney was doing, kind of searching for a spiritual path that represents the kind of person you want to be, the kinds of conversations that you're happening, you know, as you're doing that, it's easy to get trapped into, okay, well, I want to do this and this is cool. And then just go really, really deep.
Right,
but it's important to be broad, to learn from many wells, to learn from, take inspiration from lots of places.
Right. Well, and one of the challenges I keep running into with, and I had this conversation just yesterday with someone who attended my virtual con, you know, the importance, especially when you are exploring living traditions. In this case, we're talking about the Irish traditions that you're experiencing, you know, that there is a and this is part of the work that I do is like to break out of that right and wrong thinking and, you know, putting shame on yourself if you get it wrong. And, you know, somebody asked a question about an experience they have with a specific goddess and they asked it of the native teacher. And the native teacher's like, that doesn't sound like that goddess because based on the research and the mythology and also the way the Irish approach their deities, it doesn't quite sound accurate. And where I came from was, you know, I stepped in here because I could just feel this American guest just crumbling and the, I got it wrong. I'm a bad person. Oh no, I don't deserve to look on this goddess's face. And I was like, well, wait a second. This person isn't telling you that you are wrong. They're giving you more information. Let's be excited about that. And let's be excited that you've just been shown a bigger picture than what you knew before. This doesn't mean that you are wrong or bad and that you should crumble and shame over it, but instead get excited and go, okay, what this native person is telling me is completely different than the experience that I've had. Wow, the gods are so complicated. Isn't that cool? Let's keep going. You know, and because it's that, sorry, I think maybe I took us on a tangent that we weren't supposed to go on.
No, I do want to dive deeper into the conversation about cultural appropriation versus cultural appreciation in a bit. But I first want to kind of, as our audience is getting used to the conversation, I want to just, what does being a witch mean to each of you? What does, is that a term that you apply to yourself? Is it a term that you apply to yourself with love, with fear, with begrudging acceptance? Was it a path to self-identifying that way? So what does that word mean to you?
Honestly, I don't care anymore. like my first thought was, God, I hate that question. It's not your fault, right? It's so boring. Well, and I think the reason I think the reason it's boring is because, like, we all know that the answer is it means a lot of different stuff. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking about how, like, the conversation that we were just having about research and how I think there's this kind of collective impulse to portray particularly young people as being lazy, right? Like they don't want to learn, but it really is rooted in anxiety. Like I see that in my students, they're afraid of being wrong. Mm-hmm. Like think about it. Like my students spend 12 years being told that if they get things wrong, they're not going to get jobs, you know? Mm-hmm. And so when they get to me in college, of course they don't want to explore. They want the right answer so that they can be safe. And I think that applies in witchcraft spaces because like the reason we have to keep asking that question and answering it of what does being a witch mean to you is because we have to soothe people that it's okay to think different things about that word, you know? And the real answer is that word means really different things to me depending on when you catch me and who is asking.
That's fair.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think for me, it's like, it's not even a word that I mean, I use it, but it's more other people use it to define me, you know? And so for me, it's like, okay, whatever, you know, whatever. If I wake up today and I'm doing something that's hoodoo related or Orisha related or whatever, you know, you're still going to cast me as an outsider, you know, and call me a witch or whatever, whatever that means to that person who's saying that to me. So I'm at the point now where it's like, whatever, you know, I'm just doing my thing.
For me, and I move through phases of either loving it or grudgingly acceptance. And I'm moving back into the phase of love after a long period of grudging acceptance. Mm-hmm. But this, for me, it's someone who works with magic. And whether that is they are casting spells or speaking to spirits or taking cues from the spirit world. Basically, that they're connected to whatever it is that's out there. And so for me, I believe witches show up in every corner of the world, in every religion, in every culture. That being said, I don't go around calling someone a witch because I had this great conversation with David Shee, his roots are in Mongolia, Manchuria, and he's done a lot of research into bringing that into American Western practice. And he's, you know, a phenomenal writer. And, you know, he said there's a lot of people from his culture that would basically fit all those boxes that I just mentioned, but that they would not embrace the word witch. And I said, I wouldn't put it on them. I would not put that on someone because it means different things in different ways. You know, that being said, if somebody calls himself a witch, I take them at their word. I don't bristle, but I don't necessarily agree with it when I hear it coming from feminists or artists who aren't doing any kind of spirit work, but are taking a more anti-patriarchy approach. And that approach I absolutely love and support 100%. It definitely informs the work that I do. I just don't call it witchcraft based in, I don't call it witch or someone is a witch or just because they are anti-establishment or because they are anti-patriarchy. I just don't personally agree with that. But I also don't get mad if the person is using that term. I'm just like, I don't agree, but that's fine.
I want to build off that. I've long said that the witch is a fixture of both fact and fiction. There are people who have historically cast spells and conjured the dead and other things that we might call witchcraft. But the witch is also an archetype in fiction. And like Courtney very much just brought up, there's a lot of people who will assume the title of witch kind of in that fictional empowered woman casting off the patriarchy mindset. Queer folks, we were seeing a lot of like queer love for like Agatha All Along right now as well.
Yes.
Of all genders. And you know, like we saw the group witch affect the Chicago Stock Exchange, gluing the doors shut. We saw the night witches fly warplanes.
Yes.
You know, we've seen a lot of folks. How do you all each draw inspiration from both of those wells? And how do you help others understand the difference between that whole, this is a bit of fact, this is a bit of fiction, but I think that it's okay for us to draw from both? Or I don't know, maybe point a finger at me and say, actually, no, I don't think it's okay to ever draw from both.
I love the fictional witch. I mean,
yeah, me too.
Just say go for it. It's great. I love the night witches. I love that story. We had somebody from the I think it's called Shit You Missed in History class or Stuff You Missed in History on their podcast, and they talked about the night witches and just one of my favorite anecdotes from history. I mean, I think it's great. You know, I think it's great when you have that kind of do I think that the women who were climbing out on the wings of airplanes in the mid-flight to spin the propeller so they could bomb the... Can I use the word fuck on here?
Yeah.
Okay, they can bomb the fuck out of Nazis.
If you can't, then I've really fucked up a lot.
Yeah. No, I mean, I don't think that what those women were doing was witchcraft, but what they were doing was so incredible that, yeah, I want to call them night witches. That's amazing. Mm-hmm. You're climbing on the wing of a plane mid-flight at night while you're being shot at to spin the propeller so you can bomb Nazis. Let's just hold that for a minute.
And sometimes there's a place where I feel like that magical realism, that like almost Alice Hoffman style of a witch, that's just kind of like this empowered person who is tapping into something else. Like, I don't know where you get the courage and the know-how and the temerity to climb out on a wing in the middle of the night as your engine is dead so that you can... you know, fly a plane and all
and
of
you're
that.
Getting
like,
shot
I don't know,
at.
Maybe you are tapping into something beyond this world.
Yeah.
And I don't, I mean, okay, sure. Maybe there is a power beyond that you're tapping into that the rest of us aren't. Malia, I'm really curious where your thoughts on this, because so much of voodoo and hoodoo does really, and especially in the last several years, have both a problem with the way that this is portrayed in media, and that when we draw from fiction, sometimes we are drawing problematic stuff in and we have to do a lot of clarification, but also, you know, like taking immediate inspiration from. Like I saw there was a beautiful, I was going to the death exhibit because I write a million books, and I was researching death, and there was this beautiful artwork, I'll have to send it to you, that was like, I want to say voodoo, but that basically was like casting a spell on the spirit of COVID. And it was just like very much like in the culture right now, like, you know, in this fact, in this fiction, like, you know,
being right there,
like on the cusp of culture. So I'm curious your thoughts on that meeting place between the two.
For me, I don't have a problem as long as you reference a practitioner, you know, someone who practices. I think for often we've seen in media where it's just like this, make it like it's spooky, you know, and they paint this image and it's not even rooted in any type of reality. So as long as you talk to someone who actually does the work, you know, and living in New Orleans, being from New Orleans, there is a lot of, you know, second line funerals and things like that, you know. And so for me, for that is very African. But when somebody comes in and they look at it, they may think that it's, you know, being sacrilegious or what is that? You're dancing with the, you know, with the casket, all kind of things like that. But you have to really study the culture and the history of it, right? And traditionally in Africa, the dead are buried in the home area, right? Underneath the home. So when you look at the second line funeral, or you look at that and you see this dancing to all of these places, it's all of these places where this person loved in life. You know, they have to go to all these places and then they're given this last bit of libation. So I, you know, to look at it from the standpoint of a practitioner, or even to talk to a practitioner, then you get a better understanding for what's going on. And I find that oftentimes you just, it's that skipped, you know, you just go straight to, you know, what's spooky about it all. And so that's, you know, that's where I rest on that one.
So I want to continue with you for just a second, because people who self-identify as witches, there's a lot of, like, especially just white folks dealt with the satanic panic in the 80s and 90s. And there was a lot of, like, the media around witchcraft was that it was evil and it was summoning the devil and it was yada, yada, yada. Voodoo, hoodoo, African traditional religions, ATR, has also had that, but it doesn't seem to have gone away.
No.
And we aren't really getting as many, like, positive portrayal. Like, witches now, you are seeing them on Hallmark on The Good Witch. Like, you've got, we've got safe, sanitized witches, but we don't really have a lot of, like, safe, sanitized root workers in media. Yeah. When folks are navigating that harsher side of fiction, but they are still intrigued. Mm-hmm. How do you navigate welcoming them in, and how do you recommend they begin parsing out the right. harmful, negative misinformation that they're finding in fiction and course correcting?
One of the things I always tell people is to, you know, start to look at what your family does in terms of their practices. Because, like, oftentimes people don't want to be called a hoodoo practitioner or even a conjurer, you know, but they do all of these things. They have these remnants in their family of these things that they do. But that language alone is kind of like saying that they're a witch, right? So they don't want to hear that. But they will say, you know, if you ask, well, Grandma, why did we do this? And she'll say, well, we do this specific thing for this reason. We cover the mirrors when someone dies because we don't want the souls trapped in the home, you know, things like that. But you wouldn't say, what's that hoodoo practice that we do when someone dies in the home? You know, so I always invite them to start to talk to the elders in their family. Find out what are some traditional things that you do, you know, on a regular. And usually from that, they start to see for themselves, you know, what is a positive portrayal of the practice and what is not, you know. And for young people, if they have kids, I always say, go read a lot of Virginia Hamilton. Right. A lot of her work is rooted in spiritual and in the culture of all things magical for African-American people. So I would, you know, that's what I usually do. Start talking to your family members, start looking at those books and those portrayals where it's not looked up on as being something that is scary, you know, and so that pulls them into it. Usually New Orleans itself is a very different place. Right. We would go to church, and then after church, you would get some of the soil from the church to do work your hoodoo, you know. So I'm at a lot of places that just doesn't happen. You know, Marie Laveau would perform voodoo ceremonies inside of the cathedral, you know. So, I mean, that's different. And it's not always the same for other African-American people wherever they live, you know. So coming into it, it's still a very hush thing. You know, you just don't talk about it. But there are a lot of remnants that are still in families.
Thorn, I don't want to skip over you. Is there a meeting place, a comfort or a disquiet of the meeting place of fact and fiction?
I'm actually just sitting here thinking about how actually I don't have a lot of fictional witches who appeal to me. And I was reflecting on why that is. So I was
Don't we have the same favorite?
We have many shared favorites, I'm sure. Yeah. So, right. Like I love Sally and Jillian Owens from Practical Magic. Sure. I love the girls from The Craft, right? Like those were important sure. movies to me. But when I think about like my favorite portrayals of magical practitioners, many of them are like, look, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, I loved Giles. You know?
Who did? The older I get, the more I'm like, okay, I get it. Especially him playing that freaking guitar.
Oh my God. I know.
I'm like, oh no, I know that I'm reaching an age.
Freebird in that episode though, right?
Something, like, anyway. Whatever it was. I know that I'm getting old when I'm like, oh no, Giles is hot. Yikes.
Right. The pattern that I recognize, even in the fiction that I like, the difference between like the girls in The Craft, for example, and even the Owen sisters to an extent, but the girls in The Craft, I think, are a better example. The thing that appealed to me about them was that they were doing religion. Like they were going into a shop, they had some Wiccan consultant, right? Like for that movie, what you saw were like fragments.
It was Courtney, actually. She's very old.
Right? And like, ancient.
Like you had... Like that was the stuff that appealed to me. If I just loved magic powers, I would be more into fantasy. And I actually really am not a fan of fantasy.
You know, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, like, the thing that I love about practical magic isn't their spell casting. It's like the weird house or their lifestyle in this idyllic little town. It's their personal problems. It's like the drama of being real. And I think maybe some of that has to do with growing up in a very secular household. I'd really never seen religion before.
And for me, the way that magic pervades just every little part of their lives, it's in the lotions. It's part of the syrup.
Right.
It's just in everything and it's in the background. And the thing is, the older I got and the more witchy people I met, that's what real life like living a witchy life looks like, at least for all the people I've ever met. It's not constantly pulling out the sword and the robe and the this and the that and all of that. It's every little thing that you do, it is always, it's just inherently magical, which is why practical magic was my favorite for a very long time. But my favorite witch in fiction is Cassie Nightingale from the Good Witch series on Hallmark, because up until the very last season of the show, it was always just more like, you know, a good common sense, really great intuition, and then just a little spark of something else. Just a little spark of putting these together is going to attract that person to come have a conversation with me. Putting these things together or placing this object here is going to keep the person I want away from me, away from me. Like it's, and that just is what witchy people have always seemed like to me in real life. It's common sense, it's intuition, it's reading a room, it's good life skills, it's being very aware of your surroundings, it's having a great memory.
Observation, power observation. Of observation.
And, but just that little spark being a good of eavesdropper. Something unexplainable, just a little something extra, that tapping into that magic. That's what witchy has always been for me.
Right. And like the high point of the craft is when Nancy invokes the spirit into her body, whatever that means.
These are my gifts.
Right. Right. So like the thing that is the turning point is her contacting God, essentially. Right. It's not putting spells on the bullies. Like that's what she wants to do with it ultimately. Right. But this idea of like, she is kind of whipping out some of the high ritual to get this stuff done. And that's ultimately what makes her go crazy, right? And that's this very old sort of parable in a lot of spaces where when you see the face of God, right, you lose your shit. And that was really intriguing for me. And you were talking about first books. My first book was Teen Witch by Silver Ravenwolf. And for those millennial aficionados, you know, Silver Ravenwolf doesn't give you magic until the end of the book. Right. She gives you a long lecture about how this is a religion. Right. And I was like, yes, ma'am. And I read those chapters really diligently before I ever did magical work of any kind.
And see, I get crap for mine every now and then because I also don't give you magic until the very, very end. I'm going to give you 15 chapters of theory and practice and critical thinking and history and yada, yada, yada. And then you can do spells at the end. And then you can do spells. But we're going to...
I get crap for including spells, which I'm always like, I don't understand because every single title of my book, Save
so
the Tarot
mad
one,
because my book isn't just all spells.
Or magic. And like, people will say, it's really good, but I didn't want any spells in this book. I'm like, you picked up a book that
I
says witch
readers.
Or magic on the cover. I'll send them your way. I'm going to start saying, just go talk to Dawn, okay?
My readers and the reviews are great. It's just every now and then people are like, where's all the spells? I thought there was going to be a bunch of spells. I'm like, I don't know where you got that idea. I don't know. I specifically say up front, it's not going to be in this book, but okay.
I go out of my way not to include that stuff, honestly.
Love it. I still think about your last book and I forget the title. I apologize. But
which one? The one that just came out, or the one before that?
The one before that, where you're talking about. Yes. Where we came out the Dabblers and yours
came out
at
the same
time.
Yeah.
And we did all that joint stuff. It was great. Mm-hmm. But I just remember that opening chapter with you saying, it's a full moon outside and I have forgotten. And I've got my glass of wine and I'm on the couch and this is good enough. And I just related to that so much.
And I don't mean to say that I'm not a magician. I am. I'm very much a magician. In fact, I'm kind of like, I mean, I practice ceremonial magic, right, on top of witchcraft. So like, I really like all of the fancy
robes. Do you have a sword?
I have multiple swords.
You're going to have to show us your sword at the end. You're going
to, I'd have to think about which one.
Oh, it's that kind of podcast,
is it?
How big is your sword?
Anyway, my OnlyFans account
Does your sword curve?
Lean to
no,
the left.
Or is it? I'm trained in German longsword, so it's definitely a two-handed.
Of course it is.
No, so I don't mean this as like, oh, like magic is secondary to my religious. I'm not saying that at all. The reason there isn't magic in my book is because lots of other people, several of them are in the internet room with us right now, are better at that stuff than I am. The thing that I excel at is I think some of the theory behind it and some of the history and some of the classroom teachery types, like that's really what I want to lean into, because you can already go and buy 10,000 books of spells.
Yeah. There are so many books of spells.
There are so many.
Books. And I'm like, that's why I'm so excited about this round table, because we all do something that's just slightly not that. It's great. Could we all walk somebody through a 101 how-to? Sure. We've read enough of those books that we could probably vomit out a 101 in our sleep.
I would rather die. Sorry.
It would be my final sleep.
Or from the other end.
So I do want to come back to the conversation that Courtney began at the beginning, because this is becoming... honestly, thankfully, because it didn't used to be a conversation, but this is becoming a bigger conversation in online witchy spaces. I think it's translating to some offline spaces as well. But modern witchcraft deals with a lot of ethical concerns. A lot of people dabble and get into it because of ethical concerns that they have from the religion of their upbringing. In fact, as of January of this year, the largest religious group in the United States are people who identify as spiritual but not religious. Mm-hmm. We finally overtook Christianity, yay. But those people are looking to continue to have a spiritual life. They want a spiritual life, but they are looking to create a spiritual path that is reflective of their political ideals, their social ideals, the kinds of conversations they're having at home, the kinds of people who they love and are in their lives, the ideas of inclusivity and true equity and all that that implies. But, you know, while people get into this for that, there is also, while they are learning, additional ethical concerns. There's issues of identity, for example. Like Courtney brought up, there are people that sometimes we will apply the label of pagan or witch to who would not ever have self-identified as a pagan or a witch. I know that there were, I remember like 10 years ago or so, I remember there was a big dust up about people calling Hinduism a pagan religion. And that was a big problem. Mm-hmm. People will apply the label of witch to people that would never self-identify that way. But there are also issues of cultural appropriation. So how has your own practice evolved as these concerns have become more publicly discussed? And how do you discuss these issues with your own followers or readers? I'm just going to raise my hand first and foremost. Obviously, when I was a teenager first reading Cunningham, I didn't know what I didn't know. So there was a long time where there was, you know, the burning of white sage, the, you know, all sorts of stuff that I did not know was wrong. I did not know that this was appropriation. I did not know that these were things that were borrowed or stolen from oppressed cultures. So, you know, as we learn better, we do better. When did you first start becoming clued in that there were some nuance to these practices, and how has that affected your own practice, and how does that affect how you use your own platform?
You know, it's, I don't remember a specific moment. It's just kind of the thing that starts to come into consciousness through a series of uncomfortable moments and conversations that ultimately proved to be very, very helpful. And I'm very grateful for all of those experiences. You know, when I first started my journey, I had this very common fetishization of Ireland and other areas in the Celtic world. And the sense of, because I've got some, being careful saying this, because it's like, the obsession with DNA can really talk about blood.
Yeah, it gets real problematic real fast.
It gets real problematic real fast. But, you know, that's where I was 20 years ago.
Sure.
It was like trying to seek something and, you know, going over to my first experiences in Ireland and finding that it a wonderful country, and it was not the Ireland of my fantasy. And that was, you know, my first clue that just because I think something is one way that it doesn't mean that it is that way. And it was really, you know, and I wrote my Bridget book at the time without a lot of input from Irish folk, which I would certainly not do that now. And I wouldn't say I regret it, because I didn't know. It's just like you said, when you know better, you do better. I just thought, oh, well, I'm just sharing my experience and what I know and not thinking about that people are going to start to look to me as a primary source on Irish influenced magic and spirituality, when it would be better serving of the folks of the living tradition who are from there. And so,
did those lessons transfer over to when you were writing your book about, and there's 12 different ways of saying this. I'm going to say it the wrong way, according to at least 11 of y'all. Hecate, did that translate over to a lesson learned when you were writing that book?
Of course. I mean, there's always something a friend of mine taught me is everything is a lesson for something else. Mm-hmm. The challenge with Hecate is it's apples and oranges, because although I don't want to go on so far as say there's no living ancient Greek culture in modern Greece, that's certainly not true. It's not as prevalent as it is, say, in Ireland, when these myths are certainly very much alive. And Ireland is a colonized place where Greece has certainly not been without its troubles, but does not suffered under the same kind of colonization that Ireland has. So there's just, and also we're talking about practices that are not much older, but had been kind of shelved for a while and coming back into this. I did have conversations with Greek Americans about this, you know, and just trying to get their input and a perspective there. And also, I think there was it was very important to me to make sure people understand that there's so much that we don't know, and that what they're hearing from my experience is my experience and should not be like, you know, a metaphor like replaced for that. For me personally, the challenge got tougher as, you know, when people start to say something like to go back to your family roots. Okay, so my family roots are, you know, I'm looking at Eastern Europeans who deliberately abandoned their traditions. And so we don't have much, you know, they in order to succeed in white society, they had to really leave all of the, you know, any of those practice, like anything about that might be considered indigenous Eastern European practices was absolutely left in the chopping block so that they could, you know, at that time in American history, that's what they needed to do. And so then I'm looking toward, you know, my Southern Appalachian roots. So being a white person with Southern roots is extremely complicated, mm-hmm. you know? And so then I'm looking at a lot of the practices my family embraced, and many of them mirrored the practices of my Black friends who were embracing hoodoo. So then we're looking at like history that's intertwined. And so it's asking myself, okay, well, I'm picking up on something that I have seen in my family. You also see it in your family. Is it wrong for me to continue to embrace this? Because maybe my family stole it from your family. We don't know. And so the best thing that I could do was just to be really upfront and honest about what some people have called spiritual poverty, mm-hmm. about like, I don't have a lot of stuff to go on. So the stuff that I can go on may very well be already stolen from someone else. So I'm going to do the best I can with it, and also not be very mindful about not making myself the authority in a circumstance when somebody else who's closer to the root source of the culture would be a better authority. For example, at this time, I'm planning for an immersion that's just focused on the goddess, the Morrigan. And I'm flying over two Irish scholars who are experts in Irish regional history, the Morrigan in particular, Laura O'Brien and John O'Sullivan, so that we can co-facilitate this together. And, you know, just as one of my ways of, for lack of a better term, spiritual reparations, whenever I've met someone, a Black person who's interested in hoodoo and they don't know where to start, I buy them a hoodoo book. I'm like, I'm buying this for you. Here, it's for you. Take this. And that when I am sharing practices that come from my family that I think may have, you know, potentially some problematic history, I do my best to make them, you know, financially accessible or free to folks whose family lines may have taught my family. And I also just credit the source whenever I can.
Mm-hmm. So I think that sense of like humble explorer, humble novice is always something that I look for but that's true of like the best experts in every field that I've ever found always kind of come off as like humble novices, as like humble mm-hmm. explorers. But that sense, like what you were kind of reflecting on, I never want to act like the authority. I never want to act like I have ownership of this. I very much resonate with that. Like, where did it come from? There's only so much that we can know about so much of this. And yeah, we do our very best. And when we have new information that supplants the old information, we let that information guide us to do better and know better.
And I want to say one more thing.
Digging our heels in the sand is always a bad thing.
I want to say one more thing. I don't want to take up all the time on this, but you know, for so long, there, like we're talking 20 years ago, there was that it should be a quote unquote free for all. It should be free for everybody. Anybody should be entitled to it.
Mm-hmm.
Colonization, entitlement, BS, that's crap. Well, then about 10 years ago, I feel like the pendulum swung the other way, where it was like, if I don't have any ancestry in this culture, I shouldn't go near it.
Well, that lasted up until just a few years ago, that whole we're closing all the practices, everything is closed, you need to go to your ancestry.com.
And a lot of that came from white people who were then still trying to control the conversation. Yes. And then so you started to hear, there's a, I won't mention his name in case he doesn't want it public, but he's, you know, American witch of Mexican descent who does brujo work, brujería. And he would have, you know, a vending spot and white people be like, oh, I don't know that I can buy your products because I don't think it shouldn't be right for me. I don't want to appropriate. And he's like, I am literally making my living this way.
Selling this to you. Yeah.
You can't tell me that you can't take it or use it when I am providing it.
Well, and indigenous people have also had the same kind of nuanced conversation around the selling and owning of white sage. Like, it's not, you know, where do you buy it and who is getting the financial benefit and who is controlling it and how is it being taught and who is learning it? Like, it's very easy to run around the internet and close everything off and say, no, 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 don't touch that. But then we stop learning from one another and we stop appreciating one another and we start, you know, hiving ourselves off and saying, well, I can never even, you know, I talk about that in my book as sometimes things are gates, but sometimes things are windows. So it's okay sometimes for us to recognize, okay, this is not a gate to be welcomed into your culture, but sometimes this is a window from which I can maybe observe and learn and I can be inspired by, but I'm never going to take through that window, right?
Just listen to source cultures, listen to the people where it comes from. Boom, end of story.
Yes. Sorry, Mawia.
Oh, well, I know for me, within the culture itself, colorism is a big deal. And so on my father's side of the family, the ancestry is Cuban and Honduran. And on my mother's side, it's West African. And so when you look at Ifa and you call it Santeria or Lukumi, then there's some different ideas about how the gods and goddesses look, right? Mm-hmm. And so growing up, when I would visit like the Cuban houses, it would be more of a interest in the light skin of Oshun, right? You can't be Oshun if you're not light skin, that kind of thing. You have to be, you know, just somebody else. You're not her. And she, in the way in which she became light skin was that she swam in the waters. And when she got to Cuba, her skin was light and her hair was soft and curly, you know, that kind of thing. And so it's always about trying to just get people to understand the story. They all came from Africa, so they had to look like Africans, you know, and not shy away from the idea to be darker or to be, you know, a darker hue person means that you're not acceptable, you know. And so it's a lot of that, right? That also, for a lot of people, would indicate that you would practice a spirituality that is more African-centered, something that we're not doing anymore because you are a darker person, as opposed to somebody who's lighter skin, who they would say, well, you know, then you should be, you know, the Catholic. You should not be doing that. Or if you do anything, maybe Santeria, but not Lukumi, not hoodoo, you know, not those things like that. So it's really, for me, it's this internalized idea of trying to get people to really see that it's all the same thing and that we should love each other, you know, no matter how we look, you know, and just battling that. That's a constant, you know. Yeah, that's just, for me, it's over and over. I see it all the time when people come in for initiations, you know, they'll say, oh, I know I'm Oshun, you know, because I'm light skinned, right? You know, and you go, no, that's not how that works, you know. So, yeah, and it's just a carryover enslavement. You know, if you're lighter, you're more closer to white, then you're more accepted. you know, you're more beautiful, that kind of idea, and trying to get them to understand that and to read and do research, right? And to figure out where this, where these ideas stem from. And a lot of the information is not from a magical book, right? It's a historical perspective. And so I do a lot of that. I encourage them to step outside of the idea of magic and spell work and to start investing in history. You know, let's start learning some history so we can really figure out, you know, where all of this comes from. It's psychological ideas about how we look. Yeah. So for me, that's been a never ending. And, you know, when I talk to other people, it's always the same thing. You know, we laugh about it, you know, because it's just, and, you know, historically, it's always been a thing within the African-American community. There's a university in New Orleans, Xavier University. They still today want to see a picture. They don't care what your scores are. You know, they want you to send that picture. And if you send that picture and you're not light skinned, then, you know, it's kind of a thing. So, yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, it's just,
I never heard that story about Oshun, that it was that about the swimming across the ocean and thus becoming light skinned and lighter hair.
Yes.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
That feels like a story born of a lot of trauma.
Right.
Of like trying to reckon and make something positive out of it or something.
Right. And not just for the female, for the male archetypes, you know, Ogun. My husband is a priest of Ogun. And the stories that they will say about him, he's dark skinned. So they'll say where he's, you know, he's this worker, but he's also this raper, you know, he just ravages women. I mean, it's all these things that you hear. And I remember my husband, when he was first getting initiated, he's like, what? When we were reading the Cuban books, right? He's like, this is not, no. And there, you know, and our teacher, she's like, don't read that. You know, don't read that. Stop right there. You know, but, you know, you want to ingest everything you can find, and you start to see these things and you get these ideas. And I'm like, I'm telling them, I'm like, been there. I already heard all those stories, you know? So, yeah. So it's just, I think for African-Americans, it's a lot of reworking that mindset, right?
Figuring out, you're also bringing up something that she's not here with us today. And I don't know why, but Laura Davila, who wrote Mexican Sorcery, and I just had a new book come out, and I forget the name, and I'm so sorry, Laura. But when I had her on the show, and we've talked a lot as well, just kind of talking about the fact that, yes, you can read and you can learn some stuff in books, but the thing is, there's actually not a lot, because for one, it was kind of countercultural, like against the culture, to write it down. The only books that exist are from people who were willing to write it down.
Yeah.
Which is why there's a lot of, in the Brujeria space and Curanderismo space, there's a lot of white authors in that space, because those folks don't have the same kind of like cultural barriers to wanting to write it down. So, but it's you're kind of speaking to that as well, about like, okay, well, yes, there's books and you can learn some things from them, but also being in culture, being in community is a much bigger part of learning. Thorn, you have occupied a space in witchy culture as being like a big advocate of Wicca specifically, which has had a time.
I'm literally over here thinking, oh yeah, I'm gonna go last, and everybody listening up to that point is like, I know the Wiccan's not talking.
Because I mean, Wicca has a beautifully problematic history.
Well, so does all contemporary witchcraft practiced by white people.
Yes.
I'm just gonna say that. Yeah. So here's the thing for me. I see Wicca as existing pretty firmly within this wider tradition of Western esotericism, which is really deeply rooted in particularly kinds of specifically British imperialism, right? Most of what we see circulating. So, right, I would put the OTO in this boat. I would put the Golden Dawn in this boat. I would put, right, like, and a lot of the stuff that folks like Robert Cochrane and some of these other witches from the same sorts of time periods are thinking about, they're pulling from the same kinds of wells. And like, obviously imperialism is problematic. Obviously colonialism, like obviously those things
are true.
It's, And they sure the fuck are, right? Like, of course they are. And actually the thing that kind of bothers me the most is when we say things like, oh, well, Wiccans burn white sage and that's why it's stupid. Like, okay, fine. But you're actually ignoring a whole lot of other much deeper stuff that we could critique and like really engage with seriously. Right. Because like, there's actually no white sage, right? In traditional Wiccan ritual, right? Like, and if you read like Cunningham and Ravenwolf, even these books from the 90s, they're really pushing frankincense and myrrh real hard.
Oh, yeah.
I had never had white sage until, I've actually never owned it, but I hadn't even seen it before until I was in my 20s and like new age shops were really becoming a thing in my area. Mm-hmm. And I would totally believe that, right, Wiccans coming in these periods are relying on white sage. And certainly we saw it, right? I'm not denying that Wiccans use white sage. But like if the books that I was consuming, I was sitting there thinking like, you could really have some really interesting conversations about what we're actually doing and pull that apart in much more interesting ways. And to me, the antidote is always history. It's always just knowing where things actually come from. Mm-hmm. And I think that there is a tendency on the part of particularly white people who identify as liberal and progressive to kind of hit things at a surface level and not dig deeper. So like, I'm trying to think of examples, but there, I mean, like, I don't want to transform into like a historian here in front of you, but
do it. No, please do.
So a lot of the things that actually end up being more widely problematic are things like New Thought and Theosophy and some of these ideas that are coming out of spiritualism, right? And like, those things are actually bigger influences on Wicca and contemporary witchcraft than I think a lot of people realize. And they're equally present in all of the practices that like we think are safe to practice, right? Mm. But as long as we're not Wiccans burning white sage, whatever we're doing must be okay. Even if we're still relying on theosophist doctrines related to afterlives, right? Or related to the powers of the mind. Or, like there's so much that we could point to, but we just don't. Because I think on some level, particularly as white people, we're afraid of what we're going to find. Mm. So there's that. And I wish we could talk frankly, because to me, one of the strengths of Wicca is that it's contemporary, which means that we can do different shit, right? Like, because we're not actually tying it to some kind of ancient, inherited, indigenous, right, like white European form of witchcraft, that means that we can be critically engaged people and we can look at it and we can make different choices moving forward, heaven forbid. And to me, that's really, like, that is the appeal of Wicca to me.
I've always felt the same because I think that there is this problem with the appeal to history of this, like, mm-hmm. well, if we scratch the surface and if we accept that all of this is really only less than a century old, then oh no, then it must not be real because it wasn't around, like there aren't ancient Wiccans. We're right. not, you know, there weren't so, any 500 or 1,000 years ago. And oh no, that must
tarot,
mean it's
and
not.
The way that the tarot, the way we practice it, really came from 100 years ago, New York City, rich right. people on the upper whatever side.
Right.
And it that makes
and
people
I think
so
people
mad.
Are terrified of scratching that surface and accepting that it's modern. But just because something is modern doesn't mean it doesn't have an impact yeah. on you. Doesn't mean that it's mm-hmm. not effective. Doesn't mean that it's not real.
Mm-hmm. Well, and these kinds of impulses to like point to an antiquated past have been with us for a long time. So, for mm-hmm. example, in like the 1850s, 1860s in France, when the Spiritist movement, right, Alan Kardec is writing, if you're familiar with this movement, really invested in the idea of reincarnation, right? Mm-hmm. And to us, we're just like, tra-la-la, today, reincarnation, of course, la-la-la. But these were revolutionary ideas mm-hmm. in Europe. Mm-hmm. And these French Spiritists went out of their way to make the case that, oh no, actually, we didn't get reincarnation from the East. It's actually Gaulish. The French Druids believed in reincarnation, so actually, it's really French to believe in reincarnation. Right?
Like, okay, but we have some been doing of that kind of thing of, no, this doesn't originate from this minority or oppressed religion.
It's
actually
ours.
From the white people that they got it from. That still is around. We still
or
see
it,
that
oh,
on
aliens.
Social media spaces.
Totally.
Oh, yeah.
Aliens brought us reincarnation.
Yes, because black or brown people couldn't possibly have built those pyramids. It must have been aliens.
Right,
like
right.
we do this
aliens,
all the time. Yeah,
it becomes insidious. And this is kind of my second point, like if history is one of the antidotes. The other thing that's related to that, that I find really deeply insidious, and I know that more people are talking about this, but I don't think enough people are talking about this. And Courtney was pointing at it, this idea of ancestry. So the whole concept of like whiteness, in particularly in the United States, is this idea of you're giving up a kind of ethnic background in order to accept the privileges of this kind of in power majority, right? Like that's whiteness. The Italians become white, the Irish become white by sacrificing their ancestral, right? Their names, their traditional practices, whatever. And then hundreds of years later, not even that long, right? Whiteness now kind of equals no culture. And the impulse to pull away from that, because like, obviously this is bad for everybody involved. The impulse is to go to like 23andMe and tell people that you're 70% Irish or something. And it's a hop, skip, and a jump into nationalism from there.
Yep. And blood quantum. And
yep.
It doesn't take much to then be like, well, actually, I'm Italian/Irish slash whatever. So actually, this is mine, and I'm not participating in whiteness. Therefore, I'm not the problem. Right. It's those Wiccans over there with their sage.
Right. Like we have seen this in the last few years as that kind of pendulum is swinging of you know, we're closing the practices, we can only do what is directly tied to our ancestry, so let's all go get our ancestry done. So I'm you know what, I'm actually 30, the biggest percentage is Italian, so now I'm a what are they calling it, the ancestral Italian witch or something.
I mean, because, and honestly, and if you really want to look at it, like if I started invoking some of the old Slavic gods, my ancestors would come in and go, what the fuck are you doing? Stop your this is what you know.
the thing is I think, and Mawia, I want to come to you, we are doing something that I think minority and oppressed cultures are not asking us to do. Like, because when I talk to folks like Laura, when I talk to folks like Mawia, when I talk, like when I'm learning Lilith Dorsey, like when I'm learning from folks, it's not like, because like what you were talking about, colorism is such a big problem. It's we can't go and say, you know, the identity that exists inside of blackness is not about how much of a percentage of whatever you have. It's about how much time and culture you have spent. Where are you growing up? How are you existing in the world? And what community are you existing in? And how are you navigating that community? So I think we're doing something that we're not necessarily being asked to do. But I'm curious, Mawia, how this conversation about like culture and reconnection and stuff impacts you and the ways that you connect, reconnect, and help others make those connections.
I think when we think about, for African Americans, being the enslavement of African Americans, it's difficult to actually say where you're from, you know, or where you began. So, you know, for a lot of us, it's this interest in coming into it through African dance. And then figuring out, you know, if you want to learn a language, or, you know, if you say, you know, well, the majority is West African. So you start to link up with those cultures and those practices, whether it's Akan, whether it's Ifa or whatever, you know. And so for a lot of us, it's just, you know, figuring out the basis of where we came from and how we can pull from that. And I always just encourage people, because we get, you know, oftentimes seeing all of these places where you can go and look up your ancestry, it traumatizes a lot of African Americans. We start to think, well, I don't really know, you know, okay, so maybe I was dropped off here, but I'm really from here. And so it becomes a whole bigger issue. And so we just talk about, you know, let's stick with this region and let's try to understand, you know, this West African culture, and then you can branch out into other avenues. And so that usually works well for a lot of people. They find that they feel that they gravitate toward, you know, Ifa or Vodun or Palo Mayombe, you know, and that starts to waken up, you know, wake them up and their spirit, and they start to really feel like they're included. But I think the initial thing is you get really scared, and because you don't really know where you belong, you know, and it's hard to even feel like you can trust just, you know, just a DNA test, you know, you still start to wonder, you know, we've we've all read Roots. So now we're like, you know, we want to do this deep dive into, you know, all the different places that we were dropped off and figure out, you know, how much of that is in us, how much of that is in our spirit, how much of that is a part of our practice or would serve as our practice today. And so I encourage people just to look. And if you feel that this particular practice is calling you, then settle with that. I don't say that you can't search out and go somewhere else because you're probably from this region, you know, just to start to feel what speaks to your spirit.
Well, and what's so interesting is that when I'm learning from people like you, learning from people like Lilith Dorsey, learning from people like Aura, learning from people, you know, it's there is such an excitement about how things change, like how that cultural exchange happened as things kind of navigated the globe. Like, oh, well, this purification ritual came here and then it was turned into this and then it came here and it was turned into that. And so when you're here, we call it this. And when you're there, we call mm-hmm. it that. And it's all beautiful. But for some right. reason, white folks on the internet seem to have taken a different lesson of like, well, no, the minute that it came up from somebody, like the minute that we can go back and find that it came from somewhere else, stop doing it, like stop touching immediately. Right. And it's, am I correct in thinking that we're doing something we're not being asked to do. And it's less about that. And it's more about appreciating the exchange and the heritage. And again, being that kind of humble navigator, that humble explorer.
I would agree to be that humble navigator, because if you don't know, like for a lot of African Americans, you don't know. So you want to be proud of all the different aspects that make mm-hmm. up, you know, who you are and your culture. My grandfather used to always tell us all the time that he was Geechee, you know, and so we understood the Sea Islander, we understood the Igbo, we understood all of that, you know, and so that was like, you know, you wrote that down, you know, you wanted to research that culture, you wanted to, you know, experience all of it. And so just for me, it's I'm always, you know, just surprised about all of it, you know, when it all comes together and it is a big gumbo of things, you know, it is, you know, West African and it is Cuban and it, but that's okay because I feel like I have an answer for all of it. I can be a part of all of it and still be proud of who I am.
And that mirrors what I really just resonated with earlier when Courtney was talking about, you know, as I was reconnecting with my Appalachian roots, and I really got to do that a lot with my upcoming novel. I really got to explore mm-hmm. my own family history, like going back to the 1700s when we, you know, when Moses Hazlitt came over from Ireland and went into North Carolina and then up into West Virginia and just how we became mm-hmm. Appalachian. And mm-hmm. and what that meant and just learning about the ways that we evolved as we came to a place and met other people and learned from mm-hmm. them and you know, invented a way to be here, that it's mm-hmm. part old and part new and part unique. And I think that is a beautiful, just humbly navigating the world is something that mm-hmm. I think that mm-hmm. We need to bring back. We need to make that sexy. We are running long and I apologize. It's people are going to be listening to this as they're gearing up for Halloween. Mm-hmm. So I want to ask, what does Halloween look like? And do you share my correct opinion that candy corn is the worst
no.
of all Halloween treats?
What? Lies.
I love
incorrect.
Candy corn. Not too bad.
Yes, thank you, Mawia. Thank
love
you.
Candy corn.
Yes, thank
My
you.
My husband says it's poo,
also delicious.
But I love it.
No, it is wonderful.
A little
and Dawn is just
Thorn.
Wrong.
Stop.
I'm sorry, Thorn. I think you were about to say that you also agree that candy corn is the worst.
No, I love it. I was just saying the little pumpkin.
You know, I love Thorn.
It's like concentrated candy corn with a little charming stem. I love that shit.
No, come on.
Dawn, I think
it.
You just need to stop being that way and just come around. Okay. We're
I'm
here to do an intervention because we're worried about you.
Physically
well, everyone
upset.
In this room cares about you.
I'm physically upset. This physically upsets me.
Not all
you know
candy
that candy corn.
Corn
is an ancient Wiccan practice of casting out evil.
That's
and so
actually
if you don't
true.
Like it, it means there's something really problematic about you.
Gerald
so,
Gardner.
No.
Gerald Gardner's butt corn. Plug was actually made of candy corn.
How do you
That's
know
why
that?
He was so sweet.
We We never published
the reason Hitler didn't cross the channel is because they went into the forest and the candy corn.
Don't give away the craft secrets, Dawn. Not with that proper initiation.
Sorry, I'm oathbound.
You know, these
I apologize.
Are ancient secrets. Oh, I'll just tell y'all what I'm doing on Halloween.
Yeah, what's Halloween look like for all of you?
First off, I'm dressing my kid as Minnie Mouse. I'm not sure she's going to wear the ears. She's pretty anti-wearing ears, but she is pro-wearing the dress I bought for her at Goodwill. And this, we have a lot of Halloween decorations, and we will be passing out the full-size candy bars.
Yes. Oh, I see three musketeers.
All right.
I've got all of them. I have the gross candy, Starburst, and Skittles for the kids, and then the chocolate for their
parents.
Those aren't
gross. No, the gross are like the nameless.
Those are pretty gross. Those are like hard things. But
yeah, with the hard
kids
and
like
it's
sour. They like Skittles and Starburst, and the parents want the chocolate. So when the parents come to, I always offer them candy. Like, listen, you're out there.
Yeah.
I don't know what people's relationship is like with alcohol, so I don't offer whiskey.
I was
going to
say,
are you
one of those houses that like is like, hey, mom and dad, do you want to?
I would, except that I grew up in an alcoholic home, and I just have this fear that I'm going to tip somebody's dad off the wagon, and I just can't. But I always offer
that's
mom,
very
dad,
conscientious
grandma,
of you.
Aunt, uncle. I'm like, hey, mom, grandma, you want some chocolate? They always pause for a second. Yeah. And then they come over and they always want a Snickers bar. The parents always want the Snickers bar.
Oh, I don't know. I
the
would
kids
fight
always
somebody
want the Skittles.
For a Three Musketeers, like fresh out of the freezer.
Oh.
Mm,
come and get it, big boy.
Oh.
But first, you must admit that you were wrong about candy corn.
Have I ever admitted I was wrong about anything ever in my whole life?
No, that's why people love you.
I am
so
a
much.
White man. what's Halloween look like for the rest of you?
Well, I'll hand out candy. I'll be dressed as a camp counselor at Camp Crystal Lake.
Okay.
So, you know. And
is your husband going to be a serial killer?
Yes,
or
he will.
Is like looming behind you?
Of course. Yes, of course. And so we usually draw for ritual purposes. We do a Baron Samedi Veve. And we put out cigars and stuff like that. And we do we have food out, and we sort of, it's a blessing for the family as a whole. And so we do that probably a few days before if it doesn't rain, and it hasn't been raining. So we draw that in chalk. The girls, my daughters, usually do that. And yeah, we'll just be eating candy and having fun. And my mom's dressing as a witch. So
I love that. What kind? That. Are we doing like a full on Cynthia Erivo green skin braids with the hat, and we're doing a Wicked, or are we doing?
Yeah, she's doing green, and she's wants to be naughty, but not too naughty because we have kids.
Is she gonna do the iconic nose? Like, is she gonna?
She wants
I feel like
all
people
of it.
We
she
don't do the witch nose
everything.
Anymore.
Yeah, she wants it all. She wants
okay.
it all. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Thorn, what's Halloween look like for you? Are you going to remember that it's Halloween?
It's exhausting. Yeah, I'm just tired all the time, everybody. Well,
are
I
all
teach
of you
that
booked
day,
and busy?
Right?
I don't. I haven't done like Halloween. I haven't like professionally been me in October like in many years, and I forget that this time of year might actually be quite exhausting for all of you that are doing this professionally,
no,
especially after having put out books.
It's not because of that so much. It's being a classroom teacher. I think people forget that, like, when you're a classroom teacher, you don't have PTO the way other people have PTO. So, like, I'm going to be in a classroom for many hours, and then I still have grading. It's what night is it? It's a weekday night, right?
Thursday.
It's a Thursday. So that's Isn't better. It? It's, you know, than when it's like a Monday or Tuesday. So there's that. And October is also midterms month at universities. Mm-hmm. So like I have grades due in 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. So that's why I'm tired. But we also are a full candy bar house. Yeah. We don't get a ton of trick-or-treaters,
well,
which makes me sad, but we have full-size bars, and I'm seconding Courtney. The little kids like the sour stuff. I buy a lot of mm-hmm. Sour Pitch Kit, but like I like the chocolate, and that's what the kids, that's what the parents want. It's very bizarre to me. I will usually, we'll have a fire outside. We live in kind of a rural area, so we'll have a fire. The neighbors come over. There's drinking in the yard. I mean, I'll wear a costume, sort of. Actually, I have custom-made werewolf teeth that I will wear to teach that day.
Mm-hmm.
So like I certainly mark the occasion, but the teachers in your life are very, very tired.
Yeah.
They're very tired. Mm-hmm. Right. Now the kids are just like coming to my house. And I want them to, but like it's a lot.
Right. We do a jack-o'-lantern. We always do a jack-o'-lantern. I make sure that we light it at night on at sunset on Halloween night, guide the ghosts. And I will say for about 10 years or so now, a very favorite tradition of mine is dumb supper on Halloween night. You know, we
do that a few nights after Halloween. Yeah.
Yeah. We do it then. And we invite anybody that, so if you're not familiar with the concept, you basically eat dinner in silence and in remembrance of those who have passed. And it's always a very emotional experience, especially as I've gotten older and have lost more people. But, you know, there's several recipes now that have become favorites in our household to eat on Halloween night. I'll make that food. We light our candles. We set the place. We always set the food for the beloved or honored dead and set that place. And we eat dinner in silence. I will say, can I tell you a funny story? Of course I can, because it's my podcast and you're all hostage to me. So, ha. The first year that we did it, a very dear friend who kind of, she was like, oh, you know, I did this and was kind of bringing this custom to our home that we adopted. And she was like, oh yeah, when I did it, I lit a tea light and basically ate dinner. And then, you know, right as dinner was over, the tea light went out and I took that as kind of my sign that dinner was over and I could resume speaking again. So we were like, oh, okay. We love that. I love a sign. Who doesn't love a sign? So we did that. And apparently we found the world's longest lasting tea lights because we set the table and we lit the tea light and that tea light would not die. Like we had eaten.
Your ancestors were pointing and laughing like, slow it down, let's see what happens.
We'd passed around, we'd done seconds, we went in for dessert, and then we're all just like staring as one of the, because we lit a few, and we're just like watching, just waiting for literally any of them just to die. And like, I think we probably sat there in probably an hour, maybe an hour and a half of just extra silence, just staring at that candle, like we're never doing this way again. Like now we just, when dinner's over, that's when that period of time is over for us personally. That's how we do it. So yeah, so we do dumb supper and usually invite, you know, definitely anybody we've lost in the last year, but we also of course speak the name of anybody that we want to remember that evening and welcome them to the table. But I am very blessed to live in a multicultural household. My husband's Mexican, so we also do Day of the Dead. So we have an ofrenda. We have you know, photos of those ancestors that we want to remember, family that we want to remember. And you know, the next morning we'll feed the dead, and we get to kind of do this for a few days, and it's very lovely as that has become a more important and cherished part of our celebrations during that time. So that's really fun. Do y'all have any Halloween movies, like a favorite that you absolutely have to watch every year?
Bram Stoker's Dracula.
I was going to say, besides Hocus Pocus, besides the obvious.
Yeah, no, I like Bram Stoker's Dracula. That's my go-to.
Which one?
Winona Ryder.
Okay, so 92, is that 92?
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, I grew up on the original, like the Bela Lugosi Dracula.
I wasn't born yet.
Yeah, no, but my dad made sure that my sister and I saw the Boris Karloff Frankenstein and the Bela Lugosi Dracula, and they both scared me to death when I was little. Now I love watching it because you can see where all the vampire tropes from like True Blood and other places, a lot of them come from that Bela Lugosi Dracula. And I honestly think that the Boris Karloff Frankenstein is just actually a really devastating movie. The way they treated him was just, the creature is just really awful. But yeah, anyway.
Anyone else have a, it's just not Halloween until we've watched this movie?
I like To Sleep With Anger, which is not, it's more of a hoodoo type movie. Uh-huh. It's with Danny Glover in it, and he comes to the house and everything just falls apart. And
I love it.
And so I love that one. So I watch that one religiously. So
is it falls apart and it's funny, or it falls apart and it's horror?
it's horror. It's more like a psychological, you know, because he has this little, his little address book. And he's more, as he goes to houses, he's marking off, you know, where he's going next. And so, you know, from this book that he's been everywhere and he's just, you know, tore up these people's houses and their lives. And so, yeah, so I like that one because they have to, once, you know, it's sort of one of those things where you have to go back to your culture, to your source to really combat him. And so that, I like that. So, yeah.
I like that.
I'm a horror buff.
Uh-huh.
So to me, other than like obviously Hocus Pocus and the classics, right? Like we could fight over whether or not Nightmare Before Christmas is a Halloween or Christmas movie.
It's Halloween. It's I always do it like after Halloween. Like I can do it like November 1st and beyond.
That's another one that I do. I want to expose my daughter to that one this year. I think she's almost two. She's ready.
And like those are fine. But horror is the primary genre that I consume. So to me, that is not what's special about Halloween.
Right. Because you just love horror, right?
I just love horror, right?
Like, me too.
Like there's definitely like a music vibe. Like there's, but I feel like that's more about the season of fall.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
Yeah. So I don't know. Horror is for everybody all year round.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
See, I'm a baby when it comes to horror. I'm getting better. I did literally have an expert who teaches horror at a university, like, come onto my, like, and just walk me through, like, what am I not understanding? And, like, gave me a, okay, here's your top 10 movies that you have to. So I watched it and I'm like, okay, I understand why these are good. And I'm better about it. But my Halloween, again, besides the obvious, your Hocus Pocus, your Nightmare, your all of that, Paranorman. I really like Paranorman. Aww,
that's a cute one.
Yes. Yeah.
That's a really
but like,
sweet
I will
one.
Tell you, I saw that in theaters. And when there's that one scene where like the witch's powers or and then everything stops. And then there's this whispery voice. And that made me jump in the theater. More than like most horror movies ever have. But that's, I really love, I love Paranorman. I love a lot of the animated stuff because I'm a child. I'm a baby when it comes to horror. And my Halloween is very much a Disney Halloween and not the scary. Sorry. I'm a wimp. Any last little minute thoughts? If somebody listens to this and they are feeling like they want to dabble, they want to get a little witchy this holiday season, do you each have, what is that one thing that you are recommending to people? And it can't be your own book.
Oh, thank God.
I'd say light a candle for those we've lost.
I was going to say that.
Yeah. Oh, well, I got it from Moami. I just felt it. And I'm like, well, that's a good idea. I'm going to take Mawia's.
Yeah, you know, that would be the same thing with me. Light a candle. Mm-hmm. And sit with yourself, sit with your intuition, you know, and I think from there, everything else will start to spark for him. I mean, you don't need a lot of things, you know, I think you could just sit there with the candle.
Mm-hmm. Thorn?
Sorry, I'm thinking. It's very thoughtful. I mean, my knee jerk is actually never intuition. My knee jerk is there's so much great literature. I would say take some comfort and enthusiasm looking to fiction as well. If you have a favorite movie, if it's a Hocus Pocus or whatever it is, I think thinking specifically about what's appealing. Because sometimes it's like the flavors, right? Pumpkin and the way the wind smells and those things can be very stimulating and powerful kind of in and of themselves. Like, can you find the thing that gets you excited and find a way to learn more about it, right? Even if it's something simple like, you know, why do we go on hay rides when we do? I don't know, like whatever the thing is. Yeah. And I live in a rural area. So I think going to like farmer's markets and there's always a corn maze. I recommend a corn maze.
Mm-hmm.
But taking, I guess, paying attention to some of the folk culture that's around you, and how all of those things are so deeply intertwined in fiction and storytelling and pleasurable things like that. And you don't necessarily have to take it so seriously all the time. I mean, the reason some of these traditions have survived as long as they have is because they're fun.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would agree with that reading too. I just bought my daughter a book, the Black Girl Survives in this one. And it's these horror stories where the final girl is an African-American girl. So yeah, I think that that's fun too.
Okay. I want to be respectful of everybody's time. So I'm going to wrap up. We will go around. Because everybody has new books out except for me. So tell everybody your new book, tagline, where they can find it, and where they can find each of you on social media. I'm going to start with Courtney, and we'll work our way around.
Thank you, Dawn. So my latest book is Sacred Tears, A Witch's Guide to Grief. So it is navigating grief through the lens of witchcraft or magically minded people. You do not have to be a witch to take things from it. A lot of us read spiritual books when we're going through grief, and this is one more tool to add to that. And my website is CourtneyAWeber.com, and that's Weber with one B. I spend a lot of time on Instagram and TikTok at Courtney A. Weber, and I don't do Twitter anymore, but you can find my archive tweets at The Cocoa Witch.
And that podcast is called?
Oh, yes. Thank you. And my podcast is called That Witch Life. It's on all major podcast platforms. My books can be ordered wherever you get your books. You can get them on Amazon, but I really encourage folks to support their local metaphysical bookstores whenever possible.
And if you go listen to those archives, you'll hear some familiar voices.
Okay. Thorn, thank you.
Where can folks find you, and what's the name of your new book, and what's it about?
My latest book is Witches Among Us, Understanding Contemporary Witchcraft and Wicca, and it is written for general readers, but from the position of a scholar. So I am not writing as a practitioner sharing my feelings. I am writing as somebody who spends a lot of time thinking about where things come from and how they are at play in contemporary culture, but in an approachable way. You don't have to have a background in anthropology or history or religion to appreciate it.
And so if you're ever curious, write all of your books.
I do.
Me too.
On
me too.
Real paper.
Yeah. Yes.
Wait,
me
you
too.
Do too?
I do. Yes.
You're
I
actually
cannot.
The only
Both
one who
hand
doesn't
write your books.
Yes. It's just you. You're the only one in the world.
I do
who
too.
Types. Yeah.
I can't
What's
do
it
that.
Like
I'm
being wrong?
So
about
impressed.
Many things?
I feel like such an imposter.
Yeah. If you wonder why manifestation is so popular right now and where it comes from, right? I talk about that. I talk about the differences between Wicca and other kinds of witchcraft and where those kinds of overlaps are and all these other kinds of figures who are in play. So if you're brand new and you're feeling overwhelmed, I'm here for you. But also if you want a smart professional sounding book to give to your chaplain or your therapist or your minister or something, that's what this book is. So I've got plenty of witchy credentials, but if you flip it over, it's my academic credentials that feature in this one. So I'm really proud of that.
I'm so excited about it. It's so good.
Yeah, but you can find me all over the place, right? Like I'm at Thorn the Witch on most social media platforms. I've been on YouTube for like 12 or 13 years. I've actually started writing and partnering with Religion for Breakfast. So I'm really excited to lean into my scholarly kind of creds. I feel like that's the thing I can offer right now. So yes.
And it's so good. Everybody go get it. Malia, where can people find you? What's the new book?
Well, it's not
the
out
multiple
yet,
but... new books.
Right.
Didn't you just announce a second?
Well, it's not out yet. So
yes,
anyway.
Right. But we've got something coming.
Yeah. Root Warriors, Hoodoo Saints for Troubled Times. And it's a book about, well, it'll be about building altar spaces, hoodoo spaces, and looking at individuals from our culture who've passed on that we can pull energy from. And, you know, just to help us get through what we're dealing with today. And so all platforms, Mawia Bomani. And also the first book, Conjuring the Calabash. Definitely get that one as well.
Well, thank you all so much for being here. This has been a magical time getting to share space with all of you. I don't get to do this very much in my real life.
I get to
hang around with witchy magical people. So this has been such a treat.
Well, we're so excited to watch you. We're so excited to watch you too. So congratulations to you on all of your projects.
Oh, well, thank you. I have some kind of witchy stuff, but I mean, I've always said that, like, you know, I said everything that I wanted to say about A Certain Space and Dabbler's Guide, but that doesn't mean that, like, I'm done talking about spiritual things. Right, like, I have a book about loneliness coming out, and I've always been somebody that said, you know, once you're done with your 101 stuff, go outside, you know, into the other parts of the bookstore. So I still very much think that I'm writing in that kind of spiritual but not religious, like for those spiritual but not religious people who are looking to kind of create their own spiritual life. And but yeah, I mean, you know, I'm talking about loneliness, but then Verity Vox and the Curse of Foxfire is very much a celebration of, you know, Appalachian folklore and Appalachian magic and folk magic and all of that. So I got to incorporate a lot of really fun little things that are very obvious and some that are very much not obvious. So that's all coming out next year. I have multiple books coming out. So yeah. So, but thank you all so much for being here. Happy Halloween.
Thank you for having us. This was fun.
And that's going to do it here for this Halloween roundtable edition of Head on Fire. My thanks to my guests, Thorn Mooney, Courtney Weber, and Mawia Bomani. All of the links to their books and media are in the show notes. Now, if you like questions like these and want to dabble yourself, my nonfiction book, The Dabbler's Guide to Witchcraft, is available now wherever books are sold. Now, if fictional witches are more your speed, you can pre-order my debut novel, Verity Vox and the Curse of Foxfire, which is about a young witch in training who is sent to a forgotten coal mining town in the mountains of Appalachia and learns she must break a curse, find a missing girl, and solve the mystery of what's really under the mountain. It's sort of like if Kiki's Delivery Service happened in the world of Old Gods of Appalachia. All the pre-order links are also in the show notes. Now, if you like this show and you want to support it, there are a number of ways to help. You could just tell your friends about it on social media or in person or whatever, but a really great way to do it that's still very free to you and takes just a couple of seconds is liking or rating the show 5 stars on whatever app you happen to be using this on. And while you're there, leave a review, even just a few emojis, a couple of comments, the funniest joke you heard in the interview, just whatever you want in the comments. It tells the algorithm to recommend this show to other listeners like you. If you want to do a little bit more, you can support my Patreon on a monthly basis. Patrons receive additional audio and video content, as well as archived episodes, a private chat with me, and fun little preview stuff about the books along the way as I write them. Because just in case you happen to miss the announcement, I did just announce my 5th book, titled Where Did Everybody Go? It is a nonfiction deep dive into the loneliness epidemics. If you want just the book updates, you can join my free tier, or if you want the ad-free content about my podcast and all sorts of other stuff, join for as little as $1 a month at patreon.com/headonfirepod. You can also find me all over social media at headonfirepod. I'm going to go, but I'm going to tell you to never stop seeking magic like a man with his head on fire seeks water. Be well and happy Halloween.